It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Okay, jokes about people's chocolate addictions and Twinkie defense aside, today we answer the question, can you really be addicted to sugar? Hang on, because the answer is going to astound you. Our guest is nutrition editor Robin Edelman of Eating Well magazine. Shane and Michael Stern are eating in a steer skull in Arizona. Doesn't that sound attractive? Wine expert Josh Wesson has the scoop on the latest and greatest in the wine world, the cheap but delicious Malbec. Gourmet magazine's John Willoughby talks watercress, and we visit the college with America's best campus food. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, bejewel me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine, keep standing by, just entertain me, champagne me, show me you love me, kid, love me, best way to cheer me, cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug me, new thunder burn me, you heard me, I'm getting hungry. Slowly. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap, when I say do it. Send out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug me,
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today we answer the question, once and for all, can someone actually be addicted to sugar? All those times we've blamed our highs and lows on that chocolate chip cookie we had with our afternoon cup of coffee. Well, is it a bum rap? We get the last word from Robin Edelman, nutrition editor of Eating Well magazine and author of the article Sweet Addiction. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson has the skinny on the next big grape. A hint, it starts with an M, just like Merlot. And great ones come from Argentina. So move over, Merlot. It's Malbec. Gourmet magazine's John Willoughby talks watercress. We go to the college named Best Campus Food in America for 3 years running. And as always, we're going to open the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. So you two, where have you been?
We've been inside a cow skull.
What?
A giant cow skull by the side of the road north of Tubac and south of Tucson, Arizona, just off of I-19, exit 48. There is an entire building shaped like a bleached bone cow skull, longhorn cow skull, with great big horns sticking out either end and a kind of pile of earth and lizards behind it that are also part of the building.
The place is called the Longhorn Grill, and it's one of the very, unfortunately, fewer and fewer genre of roadside restaurants that look like something. There's the famous Mammy's Cupboard down in, where's that, Michael?
Mississippi.
In Mississippi, which, you know, looks like a...
You dine under the skirt of a mammy
The skirt of a mammy, and then there are, like, in California near Palm Springs, there's the Eden the Brontosaurus place. But this is a giant replica of a cow skull with long horns, and you walk in the mouth, and then you sit down and...
Well, it's not really the mouth. You actually walk in what would have been the nasal cavity.
That's true.
I believe.
This is getting more attractive by the minute.
I know. Don't you want to eat?
It's really fabulous.
Just can't wait to hear about the menu.
We should just explain, before we tell you what you're going to eat inside of this place, and by the way, it's not ribs. It's not a bone-oriented menu. We have to tell you that the building itself has been there for years and years. When we first drove by about 10 years ago, it was a defunct real estate office. And we were driving by and we thought, well, let's see what happened to that cow skull. And it's been painted gleaming bleached bone white, and it's really neat and tidy inside. You sit down, there's a bar and several tables, and you sit down and order what actually is a very nice Southwestern meal.
In fact, it was such a fabulous building, and still is such a fabulous building, that when it was for sale, Michael and I actually considered buying it and relocating and living in it, because somehow it just seemed completely sternoid to live in a longhorn cattle skull.
I'm sorry.
You're speechless.
I'm thinking of your email address.
Care of the skull.
Right.
Our email address, our post office address.
All right, but...
Okay. You want to know what to eat.
Exactly. What is the food about?
Well, it's a combination of really good meat and potatoes. They have a whole menu of big, juicy steaks, 16-ounce sirloins, T-bones, and ribeyes with excellent, excellent French fries on the side.
So it is sort of homage de cow.
Well, I guess there are parts of cow to eat in there. On the other hand, there are other things on the menu. One of the things that we just loved was it's not even called Super Nachos. It's simply listed on the menu among appetizers as nachos. And we thought, well, let's get that. It's a little appetizer before we eat any meat. And it was gigantic. It was half the size of the table, the most Super Nachos I've ever seen.
And nachos down in that part of the world are, you know, I mean, ho-hum, who cares, another plate of nachos. But these were distinguished by the excellent, excellent refried beans that were handmade in the kitchen and were kind of the glue that was the base of this giant plate of nachos.
Okay, we do steak, we do nachos, great fries inside of a steer skull.
We should also mention that there is a nice, wonderful, long bar there with a huge selection of tequila. So if you want to sit there and get ossified, that's the place to do it.
Or calcified.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Now the toe and the foot bone join together, and the foot and the ankle bone join together, and the ankle and the leg bone join together, and the leg and the knee bone join together, and the knee and the thigh bone join together, and the thigh and the hip bone join together. Now hear ye the word of the Lord.
Gene and Michael Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. Now, every week you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert with his own agenda. He believes wine isn't about snobbery. He approaches it as an everyday beverage to be enjoyed in moderation. And he's always looking for a good buy. Joshua's the creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Josh, welcome back.
It's so good to be back here with you.
It's good to have you back. Let's talk about red wines. What's going on with red wines?
Well, you know, it's cold in New York right now, and I have been drinking a lot of red wines from Argentina because I think it's the next big thing, the next big place, and specifically Malbec from Argentina, which is the most widely planted red grape there. It's driving me crazy.
What is Malbec?
Actually, it's a French grape. It's spelled M-A-L-B-E-C,
uh-huh.
And at one time it was one of the most popular grapes in Bordeaux. But the folks in Bordeaux don't grow it often because it's such a pain in the tush. It's liable to get socked with frost and mildew and rot and all sorts of exotic grape vine diseases like couleur. And the Bordelais have a problem with it. But if you take it out of a place where it's a little bit damp and you stick it in a place where there's no rainfall and it's warm and sunny, mm-hmm. like Argentina, you're going to end up with fantastic wines, and that's exactly what they have ended up with there.
What does it taste like?
Well, it's in France, it tastes like a rustic version of Merlot. It's not quite as smooth as Merlot, not quite as seductive, and it's got this positively, you know, rough-hewn backbone to it, and mm-hmm. it can be quite tannic. But when it's grown in a place where it gets plenty of sun, it ends up trading in that tannic cloak for a lot more fruit. And it has these intense black fruit flavors, which are the things that just drive me crazy with delight, because I can never get enough of, you know, black currant and black cherry, especially when you're drinking wines in the, you know, the middle of the winter or early spring.
Okay. What should we be looking for in the wine shop?
Well, the good news is that Malbec is the most widely planted grape in Argentina. And Argentina is one of the top producing wine countries in the world, although it's sort of hidden away. People don't know about it. And you can find Argentine Malbecs pretty easily, and they're very inexpensive because there's so much of them produced. It used to be maybe 15 years ago that all the Malbec in Argentina was consumed by the Argentinians, but now the good stuff's coming over here, and some of my favorites are the Trapiche, which I absolutely love, and it sells for about $10 a bottle, mm-hmm. and it will hold its own. It's a great wine to stick in a bag and give to California wine freaks, because they won't know where it's from, and they'll guess that it's $20, and then you'll be a hero when you pull it out of the bag.
All right, Trapiche, that's
and,
one.
And Santa Julia, which is even less expensive than the Trapiche. You can find it for $8 or $9, and it doesn't have the depth and complexity of the Trapiche, but at $8 or $9, it's just a hell of a good red drink.
Uh-huh. Any others?
Yeah, well, you know, people often think that Argentina and to a lesser extent Chile are basically places where you find inexpensive wines, and there's nothing good and expensive coming out of there, or I should say, there's nothing super complex. But in the last 10 years, there's been so much money funneled into both Chile and Argentina that the quality of the winemaking has zoomed up to the top of the wine world. And my favorite big-ticket Malbec is from a small producer, Mapema, M-A-P-E-M-A. And this wine is just stunning. It's one of those wines, inky black, you put it in a glass, come back to it in about 10 or 15 minutes, mm-hmm. and you can't stop thinking about it. It haunts you because it's so impossibly, irrevocably delicious. And you can't say that about a whole heap of expensive red wines.
Is that the $20 to $30 bottle range?
Yeah, you can find it under $30, but it usually is sold for about $32, $33. Mm-hmm. And if you find it anywhere in a store, I urge you to seek it out because you will have one of those epiphanal wine experiences. And with a grape from Bordeaux originally, now in Argentina, that you never heard of. It's great. It's truly a new point in flavor.
What would we be drinking these wines with?
Well, the less expensive Malbecs tend not to have a lot of tannin. So you can have them with a wide range of foods. They're great with grilled fish. They're great with all kinds of grilled birds. You certainly can have them with meat, the way in Argentina they love to eat steak.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mapemo is the kind of wine that can hold its own with just about any full-on cut of meat, a leg of lamb or ossobuco. I mean, it's right up there with giant, beautifully constructed Bordeaux wines, top flight Cabernets from California and top flight Cabernets from Australia. This is a world-class wine, and it deserves to be put against a very simple piece of meat or some cheeses that are mild in flavor, so it can really be the star of the evening. Because mm-hmm. if you put that bottle on the table, it will be the star of the evening.
Do they need age? Can we age these wines?
The more expensive Malbecs certainly can take time in the bottle to mature. But the great news about a lot of red wines from Argentina and Malbec specifically is that they're good to go right out of the bottle. And I think the rule of thumb for listeners is if you're buying a Malbec from Argentina and it costs $15 or less, you can enjoy it immediately. It doesn't need to be put in front of an air conditioner. It doesn't need to have the cork pulled. You don't need to blow on it. It's just fantastic right out of the bottle. Sometimes I don't even use a bottle. I just put a nipple on there. But
okay.
That's me.
Josh, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Josh Wesson is president of Bestsellers Wine Shops. You can find his Malbec suggestions on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and that's exactly what it is. It's ideas to feed you well midweek. You get a recipe, some tips on basic techniques, as well as ideas for what you may be finding in the market right now. You can register for it online, splendidtable.org, and best of all, it's free. Coming up, is it really possible to be addicted to sugar? We're going to find out, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls as well. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show devoted to life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food. At SuperTarget, you can find the foods and ingredients for your favorite recipes, plus the things you need to serve it up, all in one stop. Here's a question. Is sugar addictive? It's not a new idea. Scientists and nutritionists have mulled it for years. The possibility that sugar alters personality was the foundation of a known murderer's famous Twinkie defense. And since children are eating more sugar than ever, and are fatter than ever, the question bears examination. Well, recently an article appeared in Eating Well magazine entitled Sweet Addiction: Can Our Instinctive Love of Sugar Turn to Chemical Dependence? It was written by registered dietitian Robin Edelman, who is nutrition editor of Eating Well magazine. Robin, welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
Robin, we kid a lot about, oh, I'm a sugar addict, you know, the Twinkie defense. Is it really true? Can you be an addict?
Well, in animals, we've demonstrated that you can develop a chemical dependency related to sugar. We haven't quite gotten that far with humans yet, but there are some reasons to believe that you might have a stronger attraction to sugar that has a chemical basis to it.
Well, you did an article, the article in Eating Well, and you talked about a particular woman who had been an addict for quite a few years. How did it work in her case?
Well, she felt that sugar was just taking a huge part of her life. She would use sugar when she was tense or upset to calm herself down, soothe herself, but she would need more and more and repeat this. She would also use sugar for an energy pickup, and she would then be brought down from that, and she would cycle up and down with energy highs and lows. And it occupied a disproportionate amount of her time and attention. She was focusing on sugar at the expense of other foods and activities, and she was feeling out of control. So that's the sign that you have a strong sugar attraction problem, and even though we're not quite ready to call it addiction.
Mm-hmm. Is there science behind this? You mentioned that there had been research. What's going on in our bodies when this kind of thing happens?
Well, we have this circuitry in our brains that attracts us to sweet food. We get these sensations of pleasure and these desires to eat more that are generated by chemical messengers called neurotransmitters in our brain. And the main point of this article is that these chemical messengers and the circuits in which they travel, attracting us to sugar, are the same as those involved in drug addictions, especially the drugs that are the depressive type of drugs like heroin and morphine. The neurotransmitter dopamine is an example, motivates us to seek sugar in a similar fashion that it motivates us to seek more of the drug. And this individual in the article had an attraction that led her to take in big quantities of the drug and repeat this, and it became a focal point for her life, and it was making her very unhappy. Even though she wasn't having some of the same withdrawal symptoms you would get with a drug, the science behind this from Princeton University showed that rats who were made chemically dependent on sugar mm-hmm. did have the withdrawal symptoms of teeth chattering and paw shaking when the sugar was taken away.
So this is very similar to what a drug addict would go through when they go through withdrawal.
Yes, it would be more dramatic if they were going through withdrawal. It would be a more severe and a quicker start of the withdrawal, but the sugar brought on similar symptoms. So we have reason to believe that the body is getting kind of addicted to some of the components that happen as a result of eating the sugar.
Explain what you mean.
Well, we are born with a preference for sweet food, and we generate a chemical messenger known as an opioid when we start eating, and that helps us relax and eat more of the food. It makes us enjoy the taste of the food. And in the article I said, sugar opioids give us love at first bite. So you can think about this with a person who is eating in an environment where there's plenty of sugar around, they're going to continue eating a lot of sugar. But in primitive times, we would have very limited amount of sugar in fruit around that might be available only through seasons that were scarce. Mm-hmm. And this person in a primitive society would not overeat sugar the way they do today. But the opioids in the brain that tell you the sugar is pleasurable and help you relax and eat more of it would help you survive in a more primitive society where you were going to have periods of food scarcity.
All right, so the opioid is the thing that when we eat the sugar, it gives us a tremendous amount of pleasure and it keeps being stimulated, so we want more.
Yes.
But you said something else in the article. You said love at first bite, and then you said love at first sight. Now, can you explain what that's about?
Well, that's about dopamine, and that is the neurotransmitter that is very similar between heroin, morphine, and sugar. Dopamine motivates you to seek a sweet food. If you are at rest and you're watching a television commercial that shows a sweet treat, you can measure through a PET scan or some kind of imaging technique a surge of dopamine in the brain. And it's going to be similar to, maybe a little bit less, but it's going to be similar to the surge of dopamine an addict would get when they were anticipating their next fix. And so dopamine motivates us to seek more sweets. And that is a problem because we overeat sweets as a result of it.
So that's why we start salivating when we see the cake commercial.
Exactly.
On television.
TV advertising works because of a dopamine response that you can actually measure in the brain.
Okay, so now what can we do about this?
Well, we can find a way to dole out these sweets gradually rather than abstaining completely. With sugar, abstinence makes the brain grow fonder. And so you're better off actually taking small amounts on a regular basis instead of trying to go completely free of sugar, especially in our society when it's just everywhere and it's hard to avoid.
Well, thank you very much, Robin.
It's been a pleasure, Lynn.
Registered dietitian Robin Edelman is nutrition editor of Eating Well magazine. Her article, Sweet Addiction, appeared in the fall 2002 issue. John Willoughby is what you might call a food writer's food writer. He's a solid researcher, a gifted recipe developer. He's done books with his pal Chris Slazinger that keep winning awards, and now he's executive editor at Gourmet Magazine. John, welcome.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
So what have you been working on?
Well, recently I've been using a lot of watercress.
Watercress is a vegetable.
Yeah, I think this is a vegetable. It's one of those vegetables that really doesn't get its true glory that it should have. I think people, when they think of watercress, tend to think of watercress sandwiches, and so they think it's a kind of an effete little herb that there's not much to do with. But it's actually very versatile. It's like it's got great flavor, and it's got a long history in both Europe and Asia as being used both raw and cooked in a lot of different ways. It's a lot like, you can use it a lot like you do radicchio or arugula, but it's less expensive. So I think it's a great thing to be cooking with.
Well, now you're really talking if you're talking about saving money and getting that kind of hit.
Always a good thing.
But you know, one of the things I see with watercress when I see it in the stores, often it's kind of beaten up. And I think people don't buy it because of that.
That's true. I think it is often not in the best looking condition in the store. But one thing about watercress is it is a very high percentage of water, so you can refresh it very quickly by putting it in very cold water, and then you put it in the refrigerator with its stems in a glass of cold water, and in a couple of hours it'll look totally different. So you shouldn't be too discouraged if what you see in the store doesn't look perfect.
So where does our watercress come from that we see in the stores?
Well, watercress is actually a big crop in the United States. It is grown all over the eastern seaboard, also in Hawaii, and it's now a year-round crop. It's the original hydroponic vegetable. Watercress grows with its roots in cold running water, and it used to be just a springtime thing. You could only get it in the spring, and pretty much only in New England where it was cool, but now it's commercially grown in a lot of locations all over the country, so you can get it year-round in good quality.
And it has that crisp, almost peppery kind of taste, right?
A nice peppery flavor, a little hot, and it's also a little bit astringent. So while it gives you a little heat, it also cuts richness. So I mean, we like to use it with pork and other sort of rich meats because it really works well with the richness of the meats. And you can use it raw as like a bed for meat, or you can also cook it. And it is about the most popular green in China, actually.
Really?
Yeah, it's funny. Its name in Chinese means Western water vegetable, but it is really popular
from
in
New
China.
England. Yes, yes, I saw
that. Full translation.
I read that Chinese character. I saw that. Yes,
but it is very popular there. Of course, they use it cooked because they almost always cook greens. But the interesting thing to me was that almost 30% of the watercress grown in this country is used by Chinese Americans. So what that means, one of the things that means is in this country, the watercress we get is bred with very large stems because that's good for cooking.
Right.
So it's great for stir frying. This is a wonderful vegetable to stir fry. It's got that nice, peppery, bold flavor. So you really get some taste with it, and it goes well with other Asian flavorings. That's a really great way to use it.
Okay. All right. We'll try the watercress, John.
I hope so.
Hey, John, thanks.
Thank you, Lynn.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and is co-author with Chris Slazinger of Let the Flames Begin. Now you can get his recipe for watercress and endive salad with pears and blue cheese on our website, splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Chris on the line. Chris, what do you want to talk about?
I've built a couple of small houses, and I'm going to build another one that is described probably best as a cabin or a cottage, and I'm interested in making a small, efficient kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And I cook, but I am not a gourmet cook. I am by myself, so I don't need a kitchen bigger than a one-person size. I'm wondering if there are any kitchen design books that talk about efficiency in the same sense that the Cornell School of Economics used to talk about the work triangle.
The famous work triangle between the refrigerator, the stove, and the sink.
Correct.
Yeah, which, by the way, a lot of designers now say doesn't apply if you have more than one person, and they're rethinking it and all that. Are you a builder? Do you build and sell, or do you build houses for yourself?
I build houses for myself, and then when I get, it turns out when I get done, I sell them and move on and apply what I've learned in the past to the new construction, so... That's what I'm trying to do now, is learn more in particular about kitchens.
About kitchens.
Tending to cook more as I get older.
So you're looking for designs for kitchens that are small and very efficient, not necessarily, you know, filled with fancy, expensive equipment?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. This is two things come to mind. One is a book by an architect whose name I always mispronounce, but the book is called The Not Too Big House.
Yes, Sarah Susanka.
Thank you. I always think of her as Sarah Susquehanna. Susanka. Thank you. Thank you. You've read it. Okay. You know the other place I would go for what I think of as real world kitchen design ideas?
Mm-hmm.
Better Homes and Gardens Publications.
Really?
Yes. You know why? They have the resources to test, try stuff out. They are dealing with readers who often do not feel like spending $5,000 for a stove,
right,
you know, or installing a wood-fired oven.
Right.
I have found that they are really right on when it comes to realistic kitchen designs.
So they might have a website as well.
They probably do. And the other thing is, you know what I would do? I would talk to cooking teachers in your area.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of this because I am one myself.
Mm-hmm.
People who have spent much of their time in a kitchen often have some real practical ideas.
Oh, yeah.
For what
Absolutely.
Works. You know, for instance, you never want a two-tiered or multi-tiered island. It is the greatest waste of space. You see people with these, you know, islands that are divided into steps. You want to drive yourself nuts, or you want to have accidents, that's the way to do it. You want the largest flat open surface you can have so you can spread out.
Uh-huh.
Don't chop up your counter space if you can avoid it.
Right.
Give yourself as much elbow room and clear space as you can.
Right.
So at any rate, I think those are two sources.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks
and by
much.
The way, one other one, Family Circle. Again, the same concept, dealing with a lot of real world problems.
I'll be darned. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I know. You don't think of that. You think of the fancy stuff, but I think they're really great.
Great.
Hey, good luck. And
thank you.
I'd love to know how it all turns out.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Well, reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Nika or Nika on the line. How should I pronounce your name?
It's Nika.
Nika. Okay, I'm sorry for the mispronunciation.
That's perfectly all right. It's very common. I have to tell you, I'm a regular listener, and I was listening last week, and then it suddenly struck me funny that I, of all the members of my family, was listening, because of the three of us who cook, I do the least amount of cooking. It's my son who loves to cook. Now, the important thing is he's just moved to New York City and is living in the kind of apartment you expect any young man to be living in, meaning no space.
I have a vivid image.
Yeah, and what I was thinking is, okay, knowing that a person has no space, what 5, 6, maybe 7 utensils or pans would you think were most necessary for somebody to have in a kitchen who really wants to cook but has no place to put things? And then the other question is, the cookbooks I grew up with no longer really speak to the kind of cooking people are doing now. So what 2 top cookbooks, you know, with lots of information would you recommend if you were sending this person out into the world and knew that they really like to eat?
Well, for those who can't imagine this, my first New York apartment, I had to drain dishes on a rolling typewriter table, and I actually did all my actual work on the little table we dined on and then cleared it off. Okay, 5 or 6 things that he might need.
Mm-hmm.
A 6-quart pot to cook pasta and almost anything else.
Okay.
And I think the overall best bet in terms of a brand name for stuff that's really good solid cookware is All-Clad.
Okay.
It's an investment. I make no bones about it, but he's gonna have it forever.
Right.
I mean, there's other alternatives, and he can check them out. The other 6-quart pot, about a 10-inch straight-sided sauté pan.
Okay.
Then a couple of saucepans. I do a 4-quart and like a 2-quart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can reheat, you can do a little bit of stew, you can make a small amount of soup. I do a smaller pan to do eggs, like a no-stick slant side pan that's maybe 8 inches across.
Okay.
8 to 10 inches across. And then I'd have a roasting pan, the biggest one he could fit in his oven. A low-sided. And then like an 8 by 11 cake pan. Doesn't have to be very expensive at all, but that's for small things like the one chicken. The big roasting pan is going to be for all the vegetables that he wants to roast, and a lot of other things too.
Right.
You know, we can line up things and bake in that. And as far as the cookbooks, you know, there's one, I don't agree with all of his techniques, but his food is great and it's straightforward. It's called, and it's simple. And it's called How to Cook Everything by Mark Bittman.
I have to tell you, actually, his longtime girlfriend was presented that, and I don't know whether she uses it as much as he does.
Ah, so he...
So in other words, that I know is a winner. Okay,
right.
So we have one definite winner.
All right. Now, he doesn't have a lot of time, but he likes to eat well.
He rarely has any. He either has the whole day or none at all.
Right. Okay. There is a book by an Australian author. It got a big play, as I recall, in the fall. Her name is Donna Hay.
Uh-huh.
And the book is called, I think, Off the Shelf.
Off the Shelf.
You know what you do? Go to the Splendid Table website, splendidtable.org. It's
mm-hmm.
on the website.
Okay.
And it's Donna Hay, as in hay.
Right, okay.
Okay?
Wonderful.
And tell him he is going to have the best time of his life.
Oh,
this
he
is. Dynamite.
Oh, he is. How can you be there and not?
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
Yes.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia question, and here it is. What's the newest way of getting the morning weather report? Now, we're going to have that answer and more of your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Super Target believes in putting the fun back into food. It's a grocery store inside Target. To find a store near you, you can visit them online at target.com/supertarget.
Now, we're going to be back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's food query. Now, the question was, what's the newest way of getting the morning weather report? And the answer is, from your toaster. Now, this is straight from the New York Times. An industrial design student in England has created a toaster that sears the weather forecast into your morning toast. For sunny, it's a circle with rays sticking out, a cloud for cloudy, and raindrops for the obvious. His name is Robin Southgate, and his gadget works with a microprocessor in the toaster that's connected via telephone to a web server. A Stencil brands the toast. It's called Toasty, and the prototype runs $2,150, but at the moment there is no plan to mass produce the toaster. That's going to change because I'm calling Target. Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, who's next? Let's see. Ah, we've got Frank on the line. Frank, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Ellen. This is Frank Green. I have a question for you. My wife considers herself pretty much of a gourmet cook, but I have a challenge that has kind of blown her brain. I'm looking for a recipe for stuffed raspberries. Specifically, I look at that little tiny hole in a raspberry and think, gee, what a wonderful dessert that would be. I've tried just filling it with chocolate mousse, but there's got to be some better way to do it, both in terms of what you put in it, how you put it in it, and how you present it.
Well, the best way to do it, the physical way to do it, would be to use a pastry bag with a very fine pastry tip on it. You know, one that has a very small hole, and then you just squeeze and release and squeeze and release, and you filled it. But there's nothing in the world better than raspberries and cream. And I'd whip the cream, if you want to get fancy, okay, you whip the cream with a little bit of sugar, and you scrape the inside of a vanilla bean into that cream. Yeah, because vanilla and raspberries are truly a combination that probably was originated in the celestial area. It's just incredible. And so a little bit of that cream, and of course what's nice is, you know, the whipped cream will make a little crown on top of the individual raspberry. But don't ask your wife to do this if she's cooking the entire meal. You take this on.
Well, she refuses to do it. I've done this several times using almond paste and, like I said, chocolate mousse, and replace half the recipe of chocolate mousse with brandy.
This is not shabby either. Try the cream. It's a very simple thing, but it also lets the raspberries be the star, and see what you think.
Okay. And any thoughts on? I mean, just lay them on a plate, put them on a green leaf.
You know what would be really pretty is if you can get shiny, you know, crisp-looking leaves. I'm thinking of things. Where do you live, Frank?
Knoxville, Tennessee.
Well, maybe you're in warm enough climate. I'm thinking about lemon leaves. You know, citrus tree leaves, something that's really shiny, and then you could arrange a cluster of raspberries on each leaf and sort of trail them down a long, narrow platter.
Yeah, okay.
That would be kind of classy.
Wonderful. Yeah.
You know, Frank, this really isn't such a bad idea after all. I'm sorry I teased you about
it. Okay. Hey, thank you very, very much.
Okay, all right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's see who's up next. We've got Dennis calling. So, Dennis, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. First of all, what's the difference between fowl, game, and poultry? I could, and I have looked them up in a dictionary, but cookbooks seem to use these words like almost interchangeably. Vis-a-vis cooking, are they interchangeable?
Gee, you know what? That's a good question, and I'm not sure. This is purely, you know, what I think, and I don't have a dictionary in front of me. When poultry, to me, embraces anything that has wings, but usually I associate it with domesticated things like turkey, domestic duck, chicken, etc. When I think of fowl, the first thing that comes to mind is wild winged creatures.
Oh, I see where you're
going. Like waterfowl or whatever. But I do know that older chickens are often referred to as fowl as well.
And also there's game birds.
And there's game birds, which
I think
is...
I see where you're going with this thought. Though.
Yeah, and then game, to me, embraces everything but
you could say game's about something with, you know, with four legs.
Yeah.
But, you know, usually when you say game, that can almost, that can embrace everything, whether it flies or it walks or it creeps or whatever. So it is very confusing.
Yeah,
it's a good question. Now I'm going to have to go and look it up and see. And then the problem is where you look it up. You know, is it a really reliable source for,
exactly,
for that?
Exactly. I've got a cooking dictionary. I've got a couple of regular dictionaries.
Yeah.
And they don't agree.
Oh, good. This is the kind of thing I can do at 2 o'clock in the morning. This is good. You're keeping me out of trouble.
All right. Well, thank you, and keep it up.
Hey, Dennis, thank you.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see now. Who's up next? Oh, Teresa is calling. So, Teresa, what's happening?
I am calling about roasted peppers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I've recently tried some recipes for chili rellenos and used the poblano peppers. And they do take a little bit of while to peel them after you've charred them. And I wondered if you could do them ahead and how long you could do them ahead. How far ahead could you do them?
Well, first of all, you could probably do them hours ahead, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Hours ahead, because the whole thing with the chili rellenos is that you roast the pepper, you cut it in half, you peel it, and then you stuff it, and then you fry it.
Right.
And it's really, you know, sort of you're stuffing it. It's almost like a cheese. It's a fried cheese fritter, essentially.
Right.
It's so delicious.
But I've also done some with a meat stuffing, too.
Oh, you can do. You can stuff that pepper with anything you want. Yeah, exactly. But you could certainly do it in the morning for the evening.
Okay.
I wouldn't doubt you could do it a day ahead. I've just never gotten around to it. The other thing is, I don't know if this helps you, because I know a poblano does not like to give up its skin. And those of you who have never seen a poblano pepper, it's a glossy, when it's fresh, it's a glossy, beautiful, dark green pepper that's probably about, 5 or 6 inches long. And it's kind of a triangular-shaped pepper. And it's not ever terribly hot, but it can be really meaty.
Yes.
And it's delicious. Sometimes it's hard to peel, but there's a little trick. Maybe you've done this. You roast it, you know, over a flame, over your barbecue, or under the broiler until it's charred on all sides. And then stick it in a paper bag.
Yes, I made the mistake of putting it in a plastic bag.
Oh, dear. Oh, yeah.
Ooh. And I melted a hole in the plastic bag.
You are in such excellent company, I can't tell you. Do you want to know about the time I used the plastic string to wrap my roast?
Oh.
That was really that was a moment we will never forget. It took us 2 weeks to get the smell out of the kitchen.
Oh dear!
But the point here is, if you stick it in the in the paper bag, and let it sit for about 45 minutes or an hour, sometimes it's just easier to separate the
right.
The
and
skin.
I've also read you can just put them down in a bowl and put a towel over them.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yes. It just helps that.
It's
that
just
skin.
If you wanted to do more than just a couple or three, it would take you quite a long time. So
but
that's
I'd say,
why I was.
Do it a day ahead. I don't think you're going to have any sacrifice in quality.
And just keep them in the fridge.
That's
though, right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you, Lynn.
This sounds good.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see. Who has been waiting? Well, we've got Andrew calling. So, Andrew, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. One, I wanted to say that I was calling, actually, because I just got back from an amazing trip. Just spent 3 weeks in Paris and then Senegal in West Africa.
Really? What a combination. How did that come about?
Well, Paris was the route to Senegal. And, of course, it was, you know, another terrible thing, having to spend a couple of days in Paris and a couple of days on the way back. And the question I have coming out of it was papaya.
Oh,
we would have for dessert in many places papaya, a fresh papaya with just lime sprinkled over the top.
It's the best way to eat a good papaya.
My question is, how do I find a good ripe papaya?
Oh, boy. Well, it sounds like you were in a place where they're growing them.
Yes.
And some of us have been lucky enough to be in places where they grow them. When I was in Hawaii, and there was the Honor papaya stand. It was literally a grove of papaya by the road. There was a little can, coffee can, that had prices. You know, big papaya costs 50 cents, small one, 25. And you would go and either pick it yourself or take it off the table and pay for it. And I had never, I'd always thought papaya was good. This was unbelievable. And I think one of the keys is, you see, papaya is generally picked unripe. for obvious reasons. You have to ship it. When it's very ripe, it's fragile. There's evidently a fruit fly that can get to it as well when it gets to be ripe. I'd say that the season is generally spring, from what I recall. Spring and I think fall. And I think the less it has been shipped, or if it's been shipped from the Caribbean, where supposedly this fruit fly isn't as much of a problem, so they can let it ripen a little more. And I think you want to get it quite ripe, which means put it on a dark counter, not in the sunlight at all, but on a counter, or put it in a plastic bag or a paper bag.
Better
a paper bag, because you want it dark, with a banana in it, because the banana throws off a gas that helps it ripen. And it'll be ripe when it has the give of an avocado. You know how a ripe avocado has a little softness to it?
Right.
That's how you know the papaya is ripe. And when you buy a papaya, there are many, many different kinds of papaya. The one I see most often is yellow with some green. You want it more yellow than green.
Okay.
And for anyone who has never seen a papaya, the flesh can range from sunset orange to this gorgeous gold. And when you slice it in half, I think it is the single most beautiful fruit, because it has big, glossy, black seeds that look like beluga caviar on steroids. It is the single most gorgeous thing to just sit out a bunch of them on a platter, because it's a centerpiece. But that's what I would do. And the other thing is, get as close to the source as you can. Because you were spoiled. You were eating beautiful papaya. But try that approach, especially with springtime. You know, it's going to work well.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for sharing the adventures, Andrew.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
I've got a thought for you. Outstanding food in a college cafeteria? Not likely, except at the College of the Atlantic. It's a liberal arts school in Bar Harbor, Maine. It has been singled out for best campus food for 3 years in a row by a publication called The 331 Best Colleges. It comes out of the Princeton Review. Well, we have Steve Katona on the line. He is president of the College of the Atlantic. President Katona, thank you for talking with us.
Hi, Lynn.
Okay, what is a typical cafeteria lunch like at the College of the Atlantic?
Well, I can tell you what lunch is today, and it is typical. Today there's a Turkish-style vegan stew, recipe from Vegetarian Times magazine. There's a Senegalese vegetable and fish stew, which is from a rice cookbook. There is jasmine rice, curried cauliflower, some leftover Brunswick chicken stew, which is from Camille Glenn's Southern Cooking cookbook. There's some leftover haddock sandwiches, fish from last night's dinner. These are local fish, local haddock, caught by fishermen here out of Bar Harbor. Fried tofu and cookies or oatmeal raisin, marble cookies, and almond butter cookies. Those are vegan, and pumpkin raisin pound cake. So that's today's lunch.
I'm ready to go back to school. And also, only a college would actually document the source of the recipe. But why this emphasis on food?
Well, here at the College of the Atlantic, our mission is to train students in what we call human ecology, which is the relationship between people and environment, both the natural environment and social environment. And there's an intentional quality to the college, too, which is to try and improve our relationships to the social world and to the natural world. And, you know, one of the most important things about human existence is food and how we get it, how we make it, where it comes from, what the costs are, both financial and to the environment, and what the benefits are and costs to ourselves in terms of health and all the other things that food can do for us.
Well, who's actually doing the cooking?
Well, our head chef is Donna Skill. Our baker is Jill Miller. We've got a vegan chef, Valerie Radziewicz, and an assistant chef, Mark Haggerty. We've got an evening assistant, Lynn Berzinis, and a dining room manager, Alexa Pisano, who's one of our graduates.
Uh-huh.
And Sarah Landry is our evening prep cook and dishwasher. And all of these people work together to create menu, and they take suggestions from students, do their very best to make a dish that a student really liked at home, because, you know, people do get homesick when they're away from college.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, our international students who come from, all around the world, love to have something that reminds them of home. So this evening, for example, our Czech student is giving a talk on Czechoslovakia and also later showing a movie from Czechoslovakia. So she talked to the kitchen, and they prepared a Czech dinner. So tonight there's potato latkes and potato soup and roast pork.
Oh, this is lovely.
Meatloaf and lentil loaf and cabbages, all kinds of things. And for dessert, prune strudel.
Do the students participate at all in the cooking?
Oh, yeah, they participate in every way. They do help in cooking. Many students fulfill their work-study requirements or by working in the kitchen, either preparing food or serving or cleaning up the dining hall or washing dishes. And also they participate in the farm by helping to grow some of the vegetables that we eat at our organic farm. And also, and perhaps this is one of the most important things, they help to generate ideas for recipes and also to evaluate the food. There's a book, a comment book that's kept in the kitchen, and it gives feedback and really is a wonderful way for the students to communicate with the dining hall staff.
How large is the school? How many students?
Well, the school has now about 255 students, and we're growing to about 300.
Well, President Katona, thank you for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure. I hope you'll come visit us sometime and have lunch or dinner here.
You're on.
Okay. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Steve Katona is president of the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine. Now, in addition to being named Best Campus Food, the school ranks second in happiest students and third for most politically active. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Frank Zappa. You can't be a real country unless you have a beer and an airplane. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store. It's full of some of the things I like to have in my kitchen. And rest assured, all the proceeds go to support this very program. Oh, and by the way, don't miss out on our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's yours for the asking. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producer is Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.